Welcome to Food and Loathing, your weekly reminder not to let your boss cancel your trip to Las Vegas this year because you've got a lot of good eating to catch up on. I'm your host, Al Mancini, joined this week by Chef Rick Moonen in the co-host chair. The man putting our voices in your ears is, as always, our producer, Rich Johnson.
Yeah, hello.
And this is, of course, the first episode of 2022. And honestly, I don't see how that affects anything whatsoever. Nope. But people seem real excited about that every time the calendar changes.
Yay!
Yay! It's 2022! We do have a great show for you planned this week, though. You may have seen the news over the holiday that longtime Review Journal food writer Heidi Ranella retired after, I believe it was 22 years with the paper. I had a nice long chat with her about her tenure covering the local dining scene for the paper of record, and we will have that conversation coming up a bit coming up shortly is what I meant to say there. I don't know, coming up a bit shortly.
A wee bit shortly.
First, it's been a while since we've all been together. So, gentlemen, how are you?
I'm great. Great.
Wonderful.
Great. If you're talking to me, Rich.
Oh, I'm as reasonable as ever.
Yeah, good. I'm just made it through the holidays. Great times. I'm not going to say, you know, I didn't have fun, but I didn't go out as much. Did a lot here in my home, you know. We had a big thing here on Christmas Eve.
And, yeah, how's your hand doing, man? Last I saw you, it was planted in that fire pit over there.
Yeah, man. I'm like, what was that guy with the nails?
Wolverine?
That's it, I'm Wolverine.
You're Wolverine?
Suck burns. They just suck them back into my body.
I literally thought we were going to have to pry your flaming wreckage from that fire pit
because
you almost face planted in that.
And what this makes me know or realize, Rich, is that I don't invite Al as regularly as I normally do.
I see.
Because Al, he would know that if it's a good party, I dive into the fire. You know, that was a good party.
It was a good party. Christmas Eve, Rick had a bunch of people over and made paella for everybody. I did put one photo up on social media. I didn't want to invade your privacy too much with too many pictures, but we have a picture of you over there making a great paella, which was awesome.
You're not the secret love child of G. Gordon Liddy.
No. But afterwards, we have to sit around and, you know, burn wood and hang out. And I'm trying to throw a log in, and everybody's circled in close. So I couldn't get in, and I tripped, and I hit my hand on the side, which is made out of copper, and the whole thing. So I said, doesn't matter. Burn my hand. Big deal.
Yeah. Look, it didn't stop the party, man.
Copper being an excellent heat conductor.
Yes, it did. Thank God.
The large quantities of whiskey that I saw being poured that night had something to do with how that didn't hurt you. I don't know.
Yeah. Who do I have to blame for that?
Yeah.
Well, Sue actually said she shot with you right before you took a dive into the fire pit. She was feeling a little guilty.
She gave me the kiss. She goes, you want to do a shot? Sure, let's do something good. So we did a nice little shot. I forget what it was. Eagle Rare, I think. And then this happened shortly after. She said, I'm responsible for that. I'm like, really?
Yeah. Sue is to blame. She's the troublemaker, man. Everybody thinks, like, all the trouble I got into in this town over these years, like, she was an innocent bystander. Absolutely not. She's the devil on the shoulder.
Do it.
And the best devil that I could ever have with me for such
a... We love Sue.
Rich, what have you been up to? Actually, I should also mention, I've got a few things.
We did some great stuff together. Thank you for the invitation to go draft in your greatness at Carver Steak.
Carver Steak. We went to a little opening party on the 29th. They opened to the public on the 30th of December. I was surprised they didn't see you over there because this is interesting, Carver backstory. I was at Rick's party Christmas Eve, and I bumped into our friend Steve Geddes, mm-hmm. who is much... You're much closer to him and his wife, Lindsay, than I am, but I've known them both for years. And I mean, Steve is just a renaissance man, really, when it comes to food. We're going to have him on this show one day to talk about the kitchen he used to run in a strip club here in Las Vegas. It was one of the best kitchens ever.
He's one of those guys, if he woke up tomorrow morning and said, you know what, I'm tired of being the master sommelier. I think I'll be a chef now. And that's what he did.
The
next day he'll wake up and go, I'm tired of being a chef. I think I'll be a brain surgeon. He'll be a brain surgeon. The guy's just
an accomplished butcher, an accomplished chef. And we're talking about Ariole and, you know, Charlie Palmer. And he and his wife, I believe, at least at one point, the only husband-wife master sommeliers in the court of master sommeliers.
Well, first of all, he was the youngest. At one point, the youngest sommelier to get a master sommelier, level.
Wow!
And he was then, subsequently, someone younger than he was got the title. Someone he trained. someone that he mentored.
Right. So he had helped some.
Yeah, he doesn't care. He doesn't. Right. His MS, Master Sommelier, he threw it somewhere in the corner probably. He's working on something else.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that's why he's my brain trust. You know, he's my buddy, man. We hang out. I learned so much together within. We just give to each other. It's a great.
He's a great guy, and I've known him for decades at this point. But so I show up, and he and his wife are here, and they're having a good time at the party, and we're talking about catching up what we're all doing, and he tells me that they had been brought on to consult for Carver Steak. So that right there is really interesting to me because, I mean, that's already an all-star team over at Carver Steak.
La Francone.
Yeah, Francesco Lafranconi is over there. He's part of the group. You know, a lot of friends of mine over the years. Of course, Daniel Ontiveros.
Scotch 80s.
From Scotch 80 and from Bouchon and, you know, all over the place. So
it's like the best parts. You're putting it together. How could the car not be amazing, you know?
Yeah.
Said Mr. Edsel.
We certainly hope. Ooh. So we spoke to him, and I'm going to get to that cut in a second. But first, we got to the party. Rich, what did you think of Carver?
I love the room. I can't really judge the food because it was all sort of past hors d'oeuvres and a seafood area and a Fred Flintstone style rib roast carving area.
Oh, yeah,
area,
the tomahawks were just all out there carving on mass.
Yeah, just a few sample bites, but the sample bites were so good, they discouraged me from making my own roast on Christmas Day. I said, no, we're just going to have a steak. I can't recreate this, and I'm not even going to try.
They're big on caviar, too. Caviar in steakhouses, huge.
Yeah, everybody's getting into caviar these days, which is awesome, and I think, I don't know if it has anything to do with the fact that it's just easier to get quality American farm-raised stuff these days, or I'm not sure, but
Al, that could be a whole discussion, me and you.
Okay,
I got a long, deep conversation.
So I have to say, I did admire the cocktail program at Carver Steak.
Yeah, because they taste better than when you just go to your local guy and ask him to make you a sidecar.
He couldn't get the word out.
Yeah, I know.
You know, they were
from a mixologist.
It really sucks when you have to admit that good people doing good stuff is better than your average dickhead in your corner bar.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, a lot of my friends are great average dickheads in the corner bar, and they're all awesome.
Shout out to all of them, Al.
All dickhead respect. They were serving up old fashions and Singapore sling. Did I tell you my Singapore sling story? Well, I'm going to do it again.
Oh, boy.
Tell me your Singapore sling story.
2009, I'm on the White House beat with President Obama, and we're doing an Asian tour, and we go to Singapore. And I have sort of half a day off because of the time difference. And I said, well, I'm going to go to Raffles Hotel, the old colonial joint in Singapore where they invented the Singapore sling.
Perfect.
On a Sunday. I thought, I'm going to have that. I've never had one. Let's see what it's like.
I would do that.
At the home office.
Absolutely.
And I went there with 800 other tourists, and it was just fuck awful. It was coming out of a slushy machine. The demand was so heavy that they just had to make it, remake it forever. And I've been off Singapore slings. I have not had one.
Bellinis on a gun.
But then, we invented it. we know who says that.
Monica, one of the bartenders there, said, no, try this one. And I did. And it was so nice.
Now we're back at Carver.
Carver Steak.
Nice. Yes.
Yeah. Sweet, sour, tart, citrusy, all that stuff in perfect balance. And it was coming out of their little tap. they would finish it with the little garnishes. So I may have a Singapore sling again before I die, but if I do, it'll be at
only
the
from
bar
a program.
At Carver Steak.
It has to be from a program.
A program, absolutely.
A program only.
Somebody knows what they're doing.
I was kind of surprised at how small the main room is there. There's a bunch of little Warrens, a couple
booths of bars
or two here and there. The main bar is sort of the centerpiece. It must be a pillar in the entire building because you either go left or right around the thing.
Yeah.
And it's huge.
Well, I think that people are getting more into having a bit, even when you have a massive room, you want to separate it out and have a little intimacy.
Little Warrens.
Barry's is
that's
what
I was just going to say. Barry's, they took inspiration from Barry's, admittedly.
Yeah.
You know, they say, we looked at Barry's Prime. You
little
know,
patio
there's
area.
There's a lot of connection there with Barry.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
The patio area looked to be great, and as you pointed out, they're growing herbs too, so you don't have to look at Ross dress across the street so much.
I know, it's such a shame because, you know, you think the Las Vegas Boulevard view is going to be amazing, and Resorts World has so many great great patios for the restaurants that look out onto that view. And I love it when I go out and I see the Peppermill. That's fantastic. But when I see Ross Dressed for Less or Denny's, I'm like, shit.
That kind of dials it down.
You're ruining it for me. Right, but I mean, you know, like I'm one of those guys that used to bitch that there was an Olive Garden in Times Square, you know, when I went to New York.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
So let's get to a little bit about what they're doing there and some of the conversations we had. I spoke to Daniel Ontiveros briefly, and he told me what he was up to with the food program. So here's what Daniel had to say.
How does it feel to finally be open?
It feels great, man. I can't tell you the energy, the vibe. It's been a long-awaited journey to get to this point. We're fortunate enough to have a great staff. The team is super happy and pumped, man. It's great, you know.
What's interesting about this place is, you know, it's going to be such a party spot, and we know the people who are involved, and we know it's going to be crazy. And then there are articles about the Rolexes and things like that. But, man, the food is what I'm interested in, and knowing that you're in the kitchen makes me know that this is a place people will be able to come for food. Can you tell those who are more concerned with the food than the party what you have planned?
So that's one thing, you know, that it separates us from other steakhouses. We do have the classic steakhouse favorites, but a lot of the presentation that we're going to be executing is slightly different, on a higher level. So I think that's going to be the biggest draw, is that you're going to order things that are familiar to you, but presented in a more upscale, fine dining element. But yeah, that's what we look forward to serving our guests. And, you know,
what's the signature item going to be?
The signature item is, there's a couple on there. It's going to be, one is the hamachi. The second one is going to be the lobster en croûte, which, you know, will debut tomorrow. So, but not to mention that we have three different types of Wagyu, Japanese, Australian, and domestic. So we'll be able to offer that. We have dry age and wet age options available as well.
Well, I'm excited about it. I know you have a party to get back to. Thanks for your time. I'll get in after the new year and once things calm down.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Alan. Thanks. Always a pleasure, man.
And yes, Rich, I did say food program, otherwise known as food. I don't know. I'm just adding program to everything. And I grabbed Mr. Steve Geddes for a moment and asked him what he and Lindsay were doing with the wine.
This place is just turning into kind of an all-star team.
Well, it is an all-star team, and that's why my wife Lindsay and I decided that when we had the opportunity to jump on board and help out with the wine program. So both Lindsay and myself curated, collaborated, and set the wine list up. So we're here to set up the wine program. So it's pretty exciting.
Well, you know, I'm not a big wine guy. Even in the days I did drink a lot, I was always more the Jägermeister than the wine guy. But for my listeners who are big into wine, what are going to be the things they should be looking for on your wine list here?
Well, definitely the wine list is going to be a blend of both the real cool stuff, because my wife is a lot cooler than I am. So there's some really, really interesting, from natural wine producers to really kind of cutting edge, upcoming, modern little, you know, small farmer style producers, all the way up to the incredible epic classics from around the world. Things like the First Gross of Bordeaux, or DRCs, or Grange, or, you know, Vega Sicilia. But just everything from the cool stuff to the classic stuff. So it should be a really fun mix.
Cool, man. Well, it's great to bump into you. And I look forward to coming back when I can sit down and enjoy a full meal.
Absolutely. Good to see you, Al.
Okay, so that's Carver. Have you been to Carver yet, Rick?
I have not. I have not been to Carver yet, which is, you know, Steve Geddes is a good friend of mine, set up the wine program. If you hear me, you're on the list.
Well, I'm going to try to, hopefully within the next few days, maybe record a little segment over there with Daniel and maybe Nicole Brisson from next door.
Oh, yeah.
Teasing that. Maybe if I put it out in the universe, it'll come together.
Yeah.
So,
I want to go.
So if we do that, you come over and help us record that segment as well.
Yeah.
And you'll get to see the room, and maybe they'll cook for you.
The perks.
Ooh.
The perks of hanging out with Rick Moonen, they cook. I can get into places. They don't always cook for me, you know, during the off hours, but Rick's got a bit more pull. Rich, any other places that you've eaten over the holiday that are
even for me, it was slow on the holidays. It was takeout Chinese the day after Christmas, and other than Carver steak, that's been it. But I will brag on a couple of things we made at home. Christmas Eve, wife was Polish, who's a lapsed Catholic, which means no meat on Christmas Eve. You got to have the fish. Mm-hmm. I have found one of the nice places to find a great, thick, good, fresh tuna steak. Mm-hmm. Costco.
Yep.
They do very nice. We got a couple of those, and you know, we
Costco's
and the cats fed the
people remind me of a religious cult, man. They're always like trying to justify why they're members.
I will tell you the Costco story I have
a lot of
being a news reporter someday when I was in Seattle and another day. Christmas Day, a little surface turf, a little filet, and a huge pile of Dungeness crab. This is the season for Dungeness crab. Yeah. They had them fresh. I spent about an hour and a half picking two huge Dungeness crabs, which is something I always volunteered to do in my youth in the family back in Oregon. I just had a great time doing
it. I grew up picking blue crabs.
That's a whole
so you
no,
guys
no.
just look like wussies with your big old Dungeness.
Blue crab's a skill.
Yeah. I can't pick
it. Takes 12 beers to do a pound of blue crab.
That's lose weight on the blue crabs because you work more than you eat. And
I can't pick blue crab for eating later. I have to do it as you go with the big butcher paper and the things.
Open pistachio nuts, peel eggs. It's all in the same category of bullshit.
Dungeness, I'll do 2-3 crabs to have that night because I know it's accumulated.
Dungeness crab's delicious.
I had some sparkling rosé that went down way too easy. I'm not usually a rosé guy, but God, that was so good, and I don't remember the name of it. And here's my big brag, humble brag, is just some stuff around the freezer, a little red sauce, hot Italian pork sausage, can of tomatoes, can of tomato paste, salt, pepper, Italian seasoning, and the wild card, onion soup-style caramelized onions. And yes, I invested a good 3 hours 4 baseball-sized onions in the La Crusade, big one, low, maybe 1-2 on the thing. Every 15 minutes, I'd set the clock. The alarm would go off, stir them, set the thing again. You know, you're about an hour into that, and you think, this is never going to work. I got to crank it up. But no, important pro tip, Rick, let it go. Be patient.
Patience.
And after about 2-3 hours, you'll start to see little brown flecks. And after 3+, you will have that beautiful brown, about a quarter of what they were at one time, onions, and that made that sauce so nice and sweet.
Do you put the bones in there while you're doing that? Because I know, like...
Yeah, that's the gravy. That's why they call it gravy.
Well, this is separate. I did the onions first.
You had bones in there.
I did not this time. I didn't have any bones around, but yeah, I would. Oh, yeah.
No bones. It's just sauce. Just sauce.
Yeah.
No gravy.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I wanted a meaty sauce, but that was my... that was my big holiday treat, was that sauce.
That's my mother's thing. She used to do that. Yeah. There's always that one big cast iron pot on the stove and something going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done the thing where you've got pork and you got beef and you got the bones, and then the meat is sort of pulled off and it's served separate because you've got that deep, meaty
make
red
a bolognese
sauce.
If you want to add dairy product to it. You know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That sounds good. He never invites me over.
You dragged us out.
I know, man.
You really did, Rich. You pulled us right into that pot. I like that.
You need a cigarette now.
Yeah.
I'm hungry now. I should mention a couple more holiday meals I had with some restaurant friends of ours. We did Chinese food for Christmas.
Yeah.
I know Sue and I had Christmas dinner with Rob from Thrillist and his wife Mary. I don't know if you know those guys, but they're awesome. And we went to Chinglish in Boca Park. And I just really feel like whether you're Jewish or not, like, if you have ever lived in New York, Christmas and Chinese food go together.
Yeah.
Right? And doing it at a restaurant that has a sister kosher restaurant definitely, you know, brings up that New York.
There's a big connection. I always do. I mean, I ended up going to Honey Pig with the group because I love bringing a large group of people, you know, because it's just it's an eat-a-thon, you know. It's a garbage can lid with a fire under it.
I have to go there with you.
Delicious, though. We have to go.
I haven't been there, I think, like 10 years.
Oh, it's just so good. I'll go there anytime with you. I really enjoyed the experience there. It's good to bring a group, you know, just doing shots of soju and drinking a height or some kind of beer, you know, kase. It's just interactive, and that's what's fun about it. Cool.
I also did a tremendous New Year's Eve meal at Valencian Gold. They did, I think, 7 courses, but of course he threw out some extras. And man, I mean, seriously, if you only know Valencian Gold from when it was sort of that grab-and-go paella concept, you need to go back and see what he's doing in there, man. He's doing some really, really high-quality dishes, and we had an amazing New Year's Eve dinner there. Mm. Then the next morning, we jumped in the car with the dog. We went up to Mount Charleston, posted some photos of that. I think a lot of people are still amazed that the lodge burned down, but the cabins are still there that were attached to the lodge.
I missed the lodge.
I did miss the lodge. The cabins were great, though, and I would remind people that the cabins are up there, and it's a lot of fun. Found out my dog hates snow. He acts like a real prisp when he has to walk in snow. He's going to get cold, and he's all like, what am I going to do? So Ziggy's a bit of a priss, but man, I saw icicles, like 2-foot-long icicles. Like, that was weird.
Yeah.
And I'm good for that. Winter, you give me about 20, 24 hours of it winter, and then I'm good for another 5 years. I don't need to go see winter again.
If you dress right, man, it's so much fun. You know, we went up there too. We took the dogs and we went sledding. You know,
have you been up tubing up there? Have you ever gone tubing?
No.
Oh, because that looks like the lazy man, non-athletic bastard thing to do. I've done it. I just sit my fat ass on a tube and slide down
a
hill.
Let gravity do its wonder.
Yeah,
I got a tube too. We should do it. I don't know. I like the idea.
We should go up and do some tubing. Anyway, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Heidi Napranella has retired from the Las Vegas Review Journal after 22 years. You know, I worked with her there for nearly five. It was great. And you know, I she was always so welcoming of me over there. And you know, I will say this is an interesting thing, because before you work for a newspaper, it's always so easy to look at how the people who are working there and go, if I worked over there, I'd do it differently. If I was over there, I would write things differently. And then, you know, and I was one of those smart asses, I'll be the first to admit. And then you get hired at that paper and you're like, holy shit, this is a completely different game. And you have like, even I always had respect for Heidi, but I had much more mad respect after I tried to work in the same circumstances at the paper of record.
System.
This is Food and Loathing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pie, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Lauren, we are sisters.
That's true.
And we host a celebrity-obsessed podcast called Pop Apologists.
We also love Taylor Swift. Chandler, how are you managing to cope while we await Taylor's new album?
Look, I want to be put into a medically induced coma and wake up on April 19th, but I'm not sure my insurance is going to cover it.
Join us on our pop culture podcast, Pop Apologists, where we will be dishing on all things celebrity news and deep diving every word and note of Taylor's new album. Pop Apologists.
Pop Apologists.
Wow, this is such a weird thing. I'm here,
really,
here in your house,
yep.
Heidi,
yep.
And only the second time I've ever been here.
That's
we worked
right.
together for almost 5 years,
yeah.
And the article just came out yesterday, I guess, announcing to the world that you have retired from mm-hmm. writing about food here in Las Vegas.
I have.
How many years?
I've here at the RJ more than 22 years, but I did it for kind of probably 15 years off and on when I lived in Florida. I was an editor off and on, and I also did anonymous restaurant reporting, so for the newspaper. But
okay.
Yeah.
What was the paper in Florida?
The Fort Myers News Press.
Fort Myers News Press.
Yeah.
I'll look for that next time I'm done visiting my parents in Fort Myers
it's,
area.
It's gotten a lot smaller than it used to be, I'll tell you that.
So you were a journalist first.
Yes.
Before you came to food writing.
Yeah. But I always had an interest in food. I have a My parents were always really, really into food. I still make my mother's recipe for egg rolls that she used to make in the 60s. She and my aunt would make egg rolls. And not being Asian, it was kind of unusual. And just things like that. I mean, they traveled a lot, and they had very adventurous palates. And that sort of, you know, translated to my sisters and me, especially my older sister and me.
Wow. So you came to Las Vegas in what year now?
1999.
So you're 2 years before I came out here. By mm-hmm. the time I came here, you were the established food writer for the paper of record.
Really? Okay.
I mean, that's how I remember you. Were you sharing those duties with anybody at the RJ when you started?
I started as a journal assignment feature writer, but then right after I started, I overheard somebody say that they were looking for a restaurant critic, and I was like, hello, I did this in Florida for, you know, all these years, and I had clips and everything. And they were like, really? So I remember going to lunch with Tom Mitchell and Frank Furtado and Sherman Friedrich at the Las Vegas Country Club. And we got, you know, basically they laid it all out, and I said, yeah, I can do this. I've got experience doing this for years and years. And then they got into a big argument about, you know, everything, and I just left the table. I was like, see ya. But anyhow, so the, and then, yeah, it's the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah. Well, you know, you touch on that of the people who were running the paper then. How many owners have you been through at the RJ?
Owners, not too many. I guess it was Don Ray when I first started, and then Stevens pretty quickly after that. And then it was Stevens until, I guess, Gatehouse.
Yeah.
And then now, I'm not sure the name of the company now, but so that's not too many, okay. But a lot of different editors.
A lot of different editors.
Yeah. But I was used to that.
Yeah.
Because I work for Gannett Paper in Florida, and Gannett has a tendency to change editors like every 2 years. So.
Right. So it's interesting. We talk, and I joked for everybody out there listening. I joked when I came here that I did go and I looked at the first quote that Heidi ever said about me, which was in the New York Times. It's my brother had it framed, that article framed for me, and your comment.
Such a small, you know, venue. I mean, just, you know, very obscure.
Yeah, just this little paper called the New York Times, and it was about myself and the other co-authors of my book, but you were speaking specifically of me, and you said, it's kind of hard to be an anonymous critic when your entire appearance is based on the opposite, or something like that.
Something
right?
like that, yeah.
So you were kind of taking a slam at the way that I looked, which was a very, very fair slam. And I think, and the reason I bring it up is, that's worth getting into here, I think, because you were always an anonymous critic in a town that did not have anonymous critics.
Right, right.
You had that very old school idea that nobody should know who a food writer is. You should be able to go in, get the same treatment as everybody else. And that was certainly a fair slam to take of me because I was never trying to be an anonymous critic. I came to Las Vegas to interview rock stars and rock bands and work red carpets, and people knowing me was very important to who I was.
And so, it took me a while to figure out that difference because, I mean, like Norm and Doug Elfman after him with his hats and everything, I realized that people in those positions have to have something that makes them recognizable. And so you needed to. But I was just the opposite. I wanted to, you know, kind of blend into the woodwork. I just want to be the little quiet mouse in the woodwork.
Yeah, and very few people do it that way. And, you know, there was, and I read it when I first started writing restaurant reviews, I went, there's actually a Society of Restaurant Critics or
is there
some professional organization.
Yeah, maybe there used to be. Yeah.
And there's a lot of rules. Number one, which is that you should be anonymous. Another one, that you should give a couple of chances to each restaurant. Yeah. And I always felt that you definitely took your time to review restaurants. You made sure you had time to go back to see what they were all about. And nobody else in this town that I've – in my 20 years here, I don't remember any truly anonymous restaurant critics.
No.
You were pretty much it.
Yeah, I was pretty much it. You know, everybody has their own reasons for doing what they're doing. But I – you know, I came strictly from a journalism background. I mean, I went to journalism school and I came up on the print side, and that was just, you know, we didn't mingle with advertisers. We didn't mingle with the people that worked in advertising. I mean, we didn't we weren't basically allowed to make friends, you know, in the industry or anything. I mean, I remember Andre Rochow's ex-wife, Mary Jane Jarvis, and, you know, I really liked her, and we got along so well, and she was always trying to, you know, get me to go to yoga with her and everything, and I really wanted to, but back then that was so frowned upon. You know, you just – we're not. If somebody was a possible source, you did not make friends with them.
Yeah. Now, see, that's what I find interesting, though, because I think to be a critic, being anonymous is incredibly important. Being able to enjoy the meal the way that the average reader enjoys it, super important.
Right.
However, I think to be a journalist, having sources is very important.
I know. It's been a double-edged sword. It really is.
Yeah. So, and that's where I always felt that my ability to go out there, to meet people, to hang out with them, to get drunk with them, to do whatever other bad habits that they had, to hit the strip clubs with them, that was how I got a lot of news.
Right? Oh,
and
definitely.
So I was always very proud. And again, I was working for the alternative weeklies,
right?
And I worked for all the alt weeklies, not the paper of record. You're out there with the paper of record. It's a very different situation. But I felt that I could never have done your job and then still gotten the kind of scoops that I was getting off for the alt weeklies.
And I do recognize that. I totally recognize that. And that's one reason when they brought you on, they wanted that, you know, somebody who was out there more. And it was just after so many years of people pounding it into me not to be like that, it was very hard for me to try to make change like that. And I really never did.
Yeah. Well, I do think that the first few years that you and I worked together, I thought it was a great way to divide up the labor.
Me too.
Right?
I thought it was great.
And I came on and I had never wanted to be a critic. I mean, you know, that was my first
my first foray into food writing, mm-hmm. because my job as a strip club reviewer had gone away and City Life needed, they said, hey, we like the way you write reviews. Come over here and write reviews for us.
Great.
Write
I love
about
it.
Restaurants, right? So, when I went over to Vegas 7, I said, mm-hmm. I don't want to write reviews. They said, that's fine. We have Max Jacobson to write reviews. Yeah. And then Max was injured and I got stuck into it again.
Yeah.
So when I went to the RJ, I was like, wait, Heidi's going to write the reviews.
Yeah.
But, you know, you were always so great. And if I haven't thanked you in public, at least, you know, you were so gracious in welcoming me to that paper and letting this little snot-nosed kid come in. With this.
I think of you as my little brother. No, you've always been so gracious to me. I remember when not long after my daughter was killed, John Curtis took a shot at me about something, as John Curtis has repeatedly taken shots at me over the years from the very early days. And you commented, whatever the forum was, you commented, hey, take it easy. You know, her daughter just died. And I thought that was the sweetest thing. And I have never forgotten that.
Yeah, well,
never forgotten that.
You know, I've never believed that we should be enemies with people in this industry
and,
to begin with.
I totally agree with that.
Certainly just being a human being is something that I've kind of tried to at least say that I could be that kind of
totally
a person.
I totally agree with that, yeah.
So we worked there together for a while. We mixed things up. But I was really only there for 4.5 years. Mm-hmm. And you were there for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
You have seen this. I mean, I saw a lot of things change during the time that I was there. But the industry itself. I'm not an old school newspaper person.
Right.
I came up through law school and then radio and then network radio and then writing locally kind of for fun.
And broadcasting is so different than print.
It is very different.
So and different.
Again, talk about a look. It's much more important in broadcasting than it is in print.
Right.
You know, you want people to stop and see you when they're flipping through the channels.
Right.
Right. So, so this stupid thing that I've got going on that I can't get rid of after all these years is still there. But you've seen this city change. Now, Bellagio was already going strong or had just launched when you came to
Las Vegas. Had just launched, I think a couple months because I had come to – my husband moved out here almost 2 years before our daughters and I did because, you know, we had to go back and sell the house in Florida and just kind of get everything settled. And he got a job offer out here, and so we moved him out here in 97. And so we would come out and visit him. And I think I was out here right around the time Bellagio opened on a visit. But I didn't move here until it was already open when I moved here, yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, most people view that as a turning point for dining in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
As somebody who was just, you know, kind of new to Las Vegas, did you see that as a turning point, or was that just established in the Las Vegas that you came to know?
I think it was established. I wasn't around in 92, obviously, when Wolfgang Puck opened Spago, but I think that really was the turning point. And then I think everything kind of built on that. I think once people realized that, hey, this could work, you know, and I think Steve Lynn even started doing that. If you think about it, I don't know if you remember much about the early days in the Mirage, but when he had Alex Strada's Renoir, and there were a couple other places, I can't remember offhand, but I remember Renoir very clearly. That was, you know, that was kind of like the follow-up act to Spago, and, you know, okay, we're going to continue this, and we're going to put fine art in the restaurants. We're going to put fine chefs in the restaurants, and people will appreciate it, which they did.
Yeah, they definitely did. Yet it was still very much restricted to the casinos, right? Now, what was dining like off the strip when you started writing about it? Because, and then how much of your job originally was to report on the strip, and how much about the neighborhoods?
They never really set any kind of parameters. That was one thing that was good about my job when I became a critic. They the big argument the editors had that day was about, I think Sherm wanted me to be able to go back more than once, and I think Mitch didn't want that on his budget,
the expense.
You know, the expense of that. And Frank and they wanted me to be a full time critic, and Frank didn't want me to be a full time critic. So this, you know, was one of these big balancing acts. But they never restricted anything in terms of who I should cover. Now I will say, Mitch was not crazy about me covering these ultra high end ones. I don't think I have ever gone to the real Joel Robuchon because he didn't want to pay for that.
Well, you know, that was my slam back at you in the New York Times, by the way.
I forgot that, I guess. Yeah.
I was like, well, she's at the paper of record and I don't see her covering these giant restaurants that are opening.
I know,
because
they didn't want to pay for it. I mean, that was the bottom line. Yeah. So there are a couple places that I never did get to, but Because I wouldn't take freebies. I mean, they would have been happy to have me in for free, but I wouldn't accept that.
Right.
And then the paper didn't want to pay for it, so I was kind of stuck in the middle because I couldn't afford it.
And yeah, that's another thing people also realize is that – and the whole time that I was at Las Vegas City Life, I never – I'm sorry?
Do you want me to yell at him?
Oh, no. I'm not worried about that. Dogs or whoever, whatever is going on in the background, that's all good. That's all part of the fun of this podcast. But yeah, I never reviewed freebies when I was with City Life.
Yeah.
And at the time, chefs always wanted to send things out because they did know me and I was writing about news. And I would get around that by saying to them, anything you send me for free is not going in the article.
Oh, that's so great. That's great.
Right. And I stuck to that very strongly. But of course, you being a much more straightforward traditionalist, you were not going to accept freebies. And I think that there a lot of people think that all critics are just in it for the free food.
Oh, yeah,
right?
definitely.
It's more that you're in it for the food that your editor is willing to pay.
Yeah,
if you're doing
absolutely.
It at most legitimate
That's what it comes
papers.
Down to, yeah. Absolutely.
At least in the old days.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much that holds true anymore, but I don't know how much there are still critics anymore.
You know, critics of every kind, at least at like legacy newspapers, have certainly died out. You know, everything's about metrics these days, and our metrics for all of our critics, the theater, music, everybody, you know, right across the board, movies – were really low. People are no longer interested in reading reviews. I guess it's the Yelp era. Everybody wants to write their own review and do their own review, and that's, you know, that's fine. Things change, and that's just the way it is.
We also have a lot less respect for expertise as a society, and all you have to do
is... I think you might have a point there, yeah.
I mean, just look at the arguments that are going on about much more serious things than where you eat today.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and nobody
exactly.
wants to trust that a scientist or a doctor knows more than what they can find. So
that's
why would they believe
really
that
point.
You know more about food?
That's
right?
a really good point. It is. That's a really good point.
So, yeah, and I think that's sad because I think that there's a certain level of expertise that just comes from going to a lot of restaurants, but also in writing about it and trying to be responsible when you write about it.
I always felt that I had to study and learn about everything. Any kind of anything new came out, you know, any kind of new anything, except, of course, kale, which I did try, but but didn't get very far with. But I would always feel like I had to study it and try it and learn about it and sometimes, you know, try to prepare it myself if I could. That's one thing about retirement. I saw something the other day about some new trend, and I was like, God, I don't have to learn about that. You know, it's kind of a relief after all these years.
Yeah. How did you ever feel about – and I'll give you the lead into – how did you feel about writing bad reviews is the question that I'm going to write. And the part of the thing is Rick Moonen and I, prior to the holiday break, we were talking about that review of the Michelin-starred restaurant that was the worst ever.
Yeah,
that viral.
That was hilarious.
And I
loved that.
I thought she came off as sort of a hillbilly who like comes out of the Museum of Modern Art and says, my kid could have done that, you know?
Yeah.
But whatever. But one of the things that I said is whether you like her writing or not, and you know, good for her, she got a lot of hits, and our bosses would have loved it.
It was entertaining.
But the one thing I said to Rick is, it's fun to write a bad review.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah.
But I never enjoyed it, and I never trusted people who seemed to really enjoy writing bad reviews.
It's easy to write a bad review. It's easy to take shots at people. It really is. Both papers that I reviewed for really had a policy of not doing a lot of really negative reviews. And it had nothing to do with people would say, well, you didn't want to, you know, irritate the advertisers. It had nothing to do with that. It was more, you know, people who work for newspapers, I don't care what anybody says, we tend to be bleeding hearts. And I really think if a place, now, like, if somebody like Mr. Chow, if that had meal had been horrible, and frankly, when I went there, I didn't expect it to be great. And
I wrote a bad review
was.
Of Mr. Chow.
Did you? Oh, yeah. When I went, it was great. But if they had been bad, I would have been happy to do a bad review. But if it's some little mom and pop, and that's usually what it was some little struggling mom and pop that didn't quite have their act together. They were trying, but they weren't trying to make a lot of money. They were just trying to survive. And they always felt like, and I agreed with this, that, you know, do we really want to ruin these people? You know, the paper's former attorney used to always joke that I closed a restaurant down with a good review, which I actually did. There was a place on Sunset Road, can't remember the name of it, but it was amazing. The chef was from Switzerland, and the prices were like so ridiculously low, and it was great. And I wrote a review, and he was older. He was so busy that he ended up having to close, and I felt so bad.
Well, that's funny. That leads me to something that I always say, like, I don't – think I'd want to be the restaurant critic for the New York Times, because what's the big deal? You glow about a place and then nobody that reads your article can actually get into it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's
and
true.
That's a little weird. Yeah. Like I'm more interested in actually putting people in mm-hmm. seats, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I don't want to blow a place out that it becomes too huge.
Right.
I think that there's always been something for me that the amount – my comfort level – and we all write things we're not comfortable with, mm-hmm. so I don't always stick to this. But mm-hmm. my comfort level for writing a bad review is how much hype are they paying for
yes.
the good press?
Yes,
right?
Yes. And also – it also depends to me on if it's mean-spirited or not, what happened to me. Like I remember somebody just reminded me of this. I think it was my daughter reminded me. There was a place called, I think, Cozy Mills. It was in the Hughes Center years and years and years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, I remember that
Some
place.
Mexican, like a chain restaurant. And we had the worst experience there. But it was a waiter who was just nasty and obnoxious and gave our food to another table, set it down in front of somebody, and then realized it and picked it up and brought it over and said, well, here it is. And I said, but you gave it to those people, you know. Well, what's wrong with that? You know, and he was nasty. So I did write a really nasty review because it was like, dude, do you not have a clue?
Yeah, that's not cool. I'm trying to think. I wrote a great review about a horrible experience at was it Toby Keith that had the place? I love this bar and grill.
Yeah, that was – yeah.
And I was in there very early on and had a horrible experience, but I could tell that they were working out the kinks, and they came over. They apologized.
Okay, yeah.
They bought a round of drinks, whatever it is they do.
Yeah.
And it's not about the free drinks. It's
no.
about acknowledging that you know that you can get better.
Exactly. You know? It's acknowledging that you screwed up.
Yeah.
Well, we were – just at the Mission Inn in Riverside a couple weeks ago, and we were sitting at the bar, and they were slammed because they have this big Christmas thing. And I was sitting there with my husband, and all of a sudden, at one point, the bartender brought a drink over and handed it to me. And I said, oh, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't order that. And he said, no, I know you didn't, but it's on the house because you've been sitting there so pleasantly, you know. And I said, oh, that's so sweet. Thank you. That kind of thing goes so far. In that case, they didn't make a mistake, but they were really slammed.
Yeah.
And he felt like they were neglecting us, which we totally understood. But when they acknowledged that, you know, we goofed, God, that makes so many points with me.
It does. And because we all know that everybody has a bad day, right?
Yes,
but if you're
yes.
having a bad day and you recognize it
right.
and you're and I'm not saying you have to kiss my ass or you have to
no.
give me a lot of free stuff,
no.
but if you're apologetic, if I can tell that you know you can do better,
yeah.
then I'm going to come back and give you another try, and I'm going to tell readers to come back and give you a try.
If they say, look, we screwed up, you know, that to me is enough. That just admitting that they know they did something
yeah.
that wasn't the best.
But okay, so who'd you get the most hate mail from for a bad review? Have you ever had that experience?
Oh, yeah.
And I miss the days when people actually had to write you hate mail. Like hate mail that if somebody
yeah.
goes and they get a piece of
yep.
paper and a pen and they
yep.
write it down and they
yep.
lick the envelope,
yep.
put a stamp on it.
Oh, yeah.
That made me so happy when I would get
hate mail.
I know,
because of the effort
that
was involved. No, I remember when I gave Martirano a bad review when that opened at the Rio because it was so pretentious. It was just ridiculous. And I can't remember what the forum was, but he posted somewhere that I was a home ec critic. That's what he called me.
Oh,
and
man.
I was like, dude, I really don't care what you think.
Well, then we all know there's a celebrity chef in this town. We won't mention any names who didn't like what I wrote about him. So called you because he had his people call you to dish some dirt on me. Said, I could tell you about that Al Mancini. I've got stories about him.
I don't remember that.
No, I'll have to tell you off the air.
I don't remember that. Yeah, I remember Andre Rochat complaining to me about John Curtis, but I don't remember anybody complaining about you.
Wow. Okay. No, there were some, but I'm not going to drag that up because I don't want to get on people's bad side again. So you never had any chefs who were you ever told you couldn't come back into a restaurant again because of something you've
no,
never
no.
had any of that?
No, because if it was a bad experience and a bad review, I didn't want to go back anyway. So there was never an issue. But no, that was really never. I would get nasty, you know, you don't just talking about. And there were times though that I made an error and the chef would be like, okay, let me explain this to you. And they were really nice about it. And I learned something. Like I remember the first time I covered a ramen place and I made the mistake of calling it tonkatsu, and it's tonkotsu. And the guy wrote to me and explained the difference. And I was like, thank you. You know, yeah. Because I didn't know. It was one of the things that in my research I had somehow it slipped past me. But so
it's yeah. kind of funny because we hear a lot of shit from chefs in our line. And fair. I mean, look, we criticize yeah. other people. I'm always open to criticism. And trust me, I get a lot.
Yeah.
But a lot of people say, well, you know, how can you write restaurant reviews if you've never worked in a restaurant or if you've never been a chef or if you've yeah. never been in a kitchen? To which I say, like, well, being a journalist, it's really like it's
yeah,
it's easier for somebody who knows how to make deadlines, stick to word counts, write quality sentences and form paragraphs that make sense to learn a little bit about a topic and write about it
right.
than it is for somebody who's a genius on that topic
right.
to learn all those things that I just
yes,
said.
Very true. Very
and
true.
I know a lot of people these days think that they can be bloggers, and they yeah. are. And there yeah. are some tremendous bloggers out there, but they never have to worry about word count.
No.
They never have to worry
oh,
about
God.
Deadlines.
No.
They never have to worry about making sure that the art comes with the proper credits
right,
and you
right.
know who the photo credit is. And there's all this shit that goes on behind the scene. And I'm not claiming this excuses poor writing.
No.
My writing still deserves to be judged as writing. But why aren't there more chefs writing? Because y'all couldn't make those deadlines.
Yeah.
Just because you can
yeah.
write a freaking Yelp review
yeah.
doesn't mean that you could do
yeah.
that shit,
yeah.
right? So, I mean, and that's just like somebody could be a great home chef and not be able to run a restaurant.
Oh, yeah. You know? I could never run a restaurant. And you know, I really do have a lot of respect for them. I mean, my God, my daughter wanted to go into the culinary field. And I said, you know, okay, so you work every night. You never have a holiday off. Your body gets, you know, beaten up and you grow old way before your time. It's always hot. You know, yes, it's a wonderful job, but it really takes amazing dedication. I mean, it really does. And so, I mean, I have utmost respect for them. And maybe that's why I haven't ever gotten a lot of blowback from chefs. I don't know, but I do have a lot of respect for them. I really do. I think it's a much more difficult profession than most people realize.
It is, and I think that that the rise, and you tell me what you think about this, but I think the rise of the celebrity chef culture has, in the same way people want to become chefs, in the same way that I used to want to be a rock star when I was a kid,
yeah,
which is
yeah.
I didn't really want to learn how to play music.
Right,
I just
right.
wanted to be a rock star.
Right, right.
And,
right.
you know,
a,
and
that's a good analogy.
You'll see that on yeah. TV with even some of these competition shows where then they have to butcher a chicken and then they don't know how to do that,
yeah,
right? But
yeah.
they want to be the top chef or whatever.
Yeah,
the,
yeah,
you know, the
yeah.
thing is the master chef. But they don't take the time to do that kind of stuff. But,
yeah.
but those who are good, and I think all of the chefs that you and I respect, which is most of the chefs
yeah.
in this town I have mad respect for, at least
yeah.
the successful ones. Those are men and women who really take the time to learn and to
yes.
travel
yes.
and to visit the farms and to...
And it doesn't always mean going to the Culinary Institute of America or whatever. I mean, that I'm not saying it's not an excellent school. It is an excellent school. But I remember, I think it was Tom Colicchio who told me that he was going to go there and had been accepted and everything and... like had a stage like before he started or something at this restaurant, I think in Virginia, with these two CIA grads who couldn't make a hollandaise sauce without breaking it. And he was like, and Tom had worked, I think it was Tom, whoever it was said, you know, he had worked in restaurants as a teenager and was like, seriously, you can't make a hollandaise without breaking it. So that, and I also have heard stories about people from the CIA. Apparently Caesars, I don't know if they still do it, they used to have a process when you applied for a job there as a cook, they would lay out different kinds of lettuces, greens and things, and you had to identify them. Mm-hmm. And I remember somebody telling me one time that they had some CIA grads that didn't know, you know, romaine from iceberg or whatever, you know, and they were just shocked by that.
There's an old story that I used to hear about Joël Robuchon. By the way, of all the people that I was glad who knew my name,
yeah.
Joël Robuchon
yeah.
always wanted to get his picture taken with me and my stupid hair was like one of my things like that.
I can
that,
imagine.
That made it all worthwhile.
He was really, I have mad respect for him. I really did. Yeah. He was really something.
But I read that he used to ask people just to make a basic egg when
okay.
they would come
yeah.
in.
Now, yeah.
I don't know if there's any truth to that, and maybe some of my chef friends out there who have worked for him can tell
yeah.
me. But that it really is the basics
yeah.
a lot of times.
Yeah.
You know, everybody wants to learn this molecular gastronomy
right.
or
right.
you know some
right.
weird fusion.
Right.
But it's the ability to do the basics.
Exactly.
Right,
that, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, a lot of times it's not even the educational; it's how much they spend in the time that they spend in the kitchen and who they spend it with.
Yeah. Okay, so before we start talking about what's in the future for you, because our time is going by quickly here, but I hope you're going to come back on and we'll do more of this in the future and have you co-host and that kind of stuff.
Oh, that'd be great.
But as you look back, all your time as sort of the paper of record, covering the culinary scene in what has become one of the most important culinary cities in the world.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What are the big takeaways about Las Vegas, about food, about dining in a tourist town and in the local neighborhoods here?
Wow. Well, I think it doesn't – I've been glad to see more attention paid to the off-strip restaurants because a lot of them are excellent. And a lot of those chefs used to work on the strip and just got tired of the politics or the whatever, the corporate culture. And start, you know, right, everybody wants to have their own place. So then they would have their own place. And I've really been glad to see those restaurants getting the recognition that they really deserve. And, you know, the celebrity chef thing, I don't know. I still kind of have issues with it. I mean, there's one celebrity chef who you like much more than I do. he did call me one time, now that I think about it. We had written a Best of Las Vegas and I referred to him as obnoxious, and I had written it like months before because those things had a long pre-run. And he called me and said, "Hi, this is so-and-so." And I was like, "What?" And he said, "I can't believe you called me obnoxious." And just bitched me out. And I didn't even remember writing it. I'm not even positive I did write it. Somebody else might have, but because we kind of did those things as a group. So after I hung up and I was just dumbfounded that this guy called me to bitch me out about this, that I actually Googled his name and obnoxious and got like 4,000 hits.
Well, now I know what I'm doing. My homework assignment today is. So you're sticking around Las Vegas?
Yep. We love it here. Yeah, we love it here.
Do you think you're going to do any writing on the side, or are you just done with that?
I'm willing to. I've talked to Scott Dickensheets, the features editor, about doing some things maybe for the magazine or something. And just the other day, I talked to Glenn Cook about maybe doing something every now and then. I don't know that I'll be covering restaurants or dining or anything, but I think I'll be doing occasional. I don't know. I am open to writing or doing things for, you know, the RJ or anybody, you know, anybody else. I mean, we'll have to see.
Well, I'm hoping you'll write a little bit for my Neon Feast project that's
coming
out.
I do plan to.
That would be exciting. Yep. Okay. Any farewell words? I mean, there's a great story with Scott Dickensheets, which was that in the print edition this weekend? I know that you just posted it this weekend.
I didn't post it, but somebody did.
I did. But I thought I had seen it on yours prior.
I don't know if it was in print or not.
Okay.
Scott just told me in advance they wanted to do some kind of a farewell thing, and I was like, oh, because I do like to keep a low profile. Mm-hmm. And then he said to me, oh, they want a Q&A, and I was like, they want a Q&A? That's weird. But I don't know if it was you. Somebody was just saying that they thought the Q&A worked really well. So
yeah, I thought it was really good, and I hope people go online. And, you know, I always encourage people to always subscribe to the Review Journal.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if you don't want us having to worry – if you don't want writers having to worry about how many clicks every single story gets, then maybe subscribe to some papers.
Yes, exactly.
Do it that way so they don't have to count clicks.
Exactly.
Anything else that you want to tell people as you head off into the next phase?
Well, I have to say – please continue to support independent restaurants because they are fighting a struggle, not just during and after and before and everything with COVID, but it's a day-to-day thing. I mean, it's always a really rough profession. And I have to say I was gratified. I don't know if you saw it because you don't watch football.
No.
But there's been a commercial on the football games that Domino's
buying the gift cards. Yeah, I have seen that.
I just thought that was the most wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And I've always been big on supporting local restaurants, but I've gotten to the point where that's all I want to do is just local.
Well, I have to say, and I said this on social media, but I'll say it again. Some of the most gratifying stories that I've ever written were stories I shared bylines with you.
Yeah.
Now, I'll grant you, after we wrote them for the second or third time, I got a little bored of them because, you know, that's something about newspapers. The story's good once, you go back and write it again.
I know. COVID.
But, But honestly, during COVID, I thought the ability that you and I had to go out, and this is me coming from, you know, trying to be Mr. Counterculture, always working at the little alternative, alt weeklies, whatever.
And me being the conservative little old lady.
Yeah. No, but I think being at the paper of record, I was never more proud to work at the Review Journal because we were able to interview struggling restaurants.
Yes, yes.
And know that, and I may not have agreed with what they said, but I know that what they said was landing in the governor's office because
yes.
we were writing it in the Las Vegas Review Journal.
Yes, yes.
And that was very important to me that you and I together were able to put our, you know,
yes.
put our work into getting their voices heard by the powers that
I
be.
I feel like we certainly tried, and I think we succeeded at helping the industry. I really do. Yeah.
So that I want to thank you for
and thank you.
Thank you for welcoming me to the RJ almost
Absolutely.
5 years ago.
Absolutely.
Thank you for always being supportive of my work there, and thank you for everything you've done for this town.
And thank
all
you.
This time. And hopefully we'll have you back sometime soon.
That'd be great.
We are back at Moon and Ranch and ready to head into the news. Honestly, I'm still sort of going through a lot of press releases that came in over the holidays. I did make it over to Bally's for a media preview of the new Dave's Hot Chicken location. I know we've spoken about this place in the past when they opened on West Sahara. Turns out that one is a corporate operation. The one at Bally's is a franchise. I got a little bit of the backstory on the company from the franchisee, and his name, I'm sure I'm going to mangle this here. It's Steve Yazeji. He's also the man behind the Wahlburgers location over there in the Grand Bazaar shops. So I guess that's a whole thing of being a franchise guy, and I don't really know how that world works. I'm not going to say much about it, but he did share some backstory on Dave's Hot Chicken, so here's all you need to know.
Dave's Hot Chicken was started by four very good friends in Hollywood, California a couple years ago, and they started in a parking lot, just them four, a couple of fryers, and here we are today with their first Las Vegas strip store. Great company, great people. They've sold the rights to about 500 stores now. So they went from a parking lot to 500 stores. So they must be doing something right, right?
I actually had my first taste. Have you guys done Dave's either over on Sahara or this new spot?
I have not, but I've had other hot chickens, and while it is nice, I don't see the religious like cult following of deep frying a chicken breast and dunking it in a hot sauce and calling it something wonderful.
It's quite the American thing, like of just like blowing out your taste buds to the point where you can't taste anything else and then proving that you're man enough
like,
to eat it.
I think it depends on what level you get it, though. I mean, you don't have to go to the super hot level. You know, I remember my first hot chicken experience, and it wasn't that long ago. You know, I was traveling. It was in Texas, and you know, I had to have a lunch before I got on the plane because there was a gap between. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I just went to Hattie B's for lunch. Something brought me there. It was fantastic. It was terrific. I really, really, really loved it. Fell in love with the hot chicken, the whole concept, the way it was. And there's a lot more momentum going on. Dave's I haven't tried yet, but I'm telling you, 500 locations?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's definitely the trend. People are jumping on it. And I love it whenever a regional cuisine starts catching on. You know, I was down in Nashville shooting a TV show a decade ago, and we were eating hot chicken there. And that was sort of the, you know, the local thing. And, you know, we were trying to bring that to the attention of the world at the time. Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't do that for various reasons, but the world has caught on to hot chicken. And I'm all for it if people like it, if you like things spicy. I got to say right off the bat, I'm a pussy. I am like, my taste buds are overpowered by heat really easily. And then I can't taste anything else for the rest of the day. So at Dave's, they have like seven levels. One is plain, like literally no spice. So I got level three out of their seven, which they call mild. And for me, it was a little painful, but I could still taste things. So
yeah, that's
three,
the thing.
I liked that, right, at the three. So that's where I am. I don't think I should be an expert. Nobody should take my opinion on whether it's good hot chicken, not bad hot chicken. Weird thing was, first, I was impressed with the portion sizes because I saw the prices, and it was like maybe $14 for a value meal. Or I don't know. Don't quote me on that. But it seemed a little high. But then I saw what they gave you. You could either get two tenders or a slider and a tender, and then with fries and drinks and all that shit. So I got the slider and the tender, and they were big. I mean, they were almost the same
fucking thing. I've got to be honest with you. Except that, like, one was a big piece of boneless chicken that they called a slider on a bun. And it wasn't really a slider size sandwich. It was a sandwich. And then the other one, which was the tender, was pretty much the exact same piece of boneless chicken on a piece of Wonder Bread, right? And then they put cheese sauce on them, which was good, and it was solid, and it was a good-sized portion. But, you know, was I blown away by it? No. Would I go to the Strip to get it? Absolutely not. But if I was in that neighborhood on West Sahara, then I certainly wouldn't tell people not to eat there. I think it's solid. You give it a shot. If you're more into hot food than I am, please let me know what you think of the 7, which is the Reaper, which I believe you have to sign a waiver try, because that's what America needs.
Throat closes up.
Stunt food.
Yeah, stunt food. So anyway, man, it's cool. Good luck to them. I wish them all the best. And they're over there at the Grand Bazaar Shops now. That's their second Vegas location.
I was going to try to find some cool game show music, but I didn't because, you know, rights and things like that. But it's time for a food news quiz.
Oh,
these
boy.
Two food authorities across the table for me.
Okay.
All right.
Yes.
I have not seen any answers.
Quiz program.
This is the website called Stacker recently listed more than 24 items around that are foods around the world that are illegal in the United States of America.
All right.
So I picked out a few of these, and I will reveal what they are, and you guys tell me why they're illegal.
Okay.
And first one's going to be fairly easy. If I get the pronunciation right here, epoussa, mondour, brie, camembert from France, raw milk from anywhere. What's the deal, panel?
Because it's not pasteurized.
You can't sell, unpasteurized products you can't sell in America.
You can't raw milk,
It's a little weird. You can make your own. I've known chefs who will buy their own goats, and then they can make their own raw goat milk cheeses.
Yeah.
But you can't sell it commercially.
No.
All right, number two is slightly related. It is also a cheese. Kazu Marzu cheese from Italy.
It has live worms in it.
Bung.
Maggots.
Worms. Yeah, maggots. Yeah. Eat the maggots.
All right, you're bad in the thumb.
No,
but can you buy maggots here?
I don't know.
That's a little weird. I don't know why you can't buy maggots.
You can get them dried.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dried maggots.
Different. Haggis and black pudding.
What about it?
It's got to be the offal. Probably there's lungs or spleen or something in it.
Yeah, it's oats and guts just jammed into a big old body part boiled, and
I mean,
it's an excuse to drink more scotch.
Because you need the scotch to get by that. You were close. The USDA rules that livestock lungs shall not be saved for use as human food.
Right.
So the casing in the haggis and the chopped up lungs in the black pudding.
You know, people get pissed about these regulations, but I've got to say, man, like America, we are such a factory farm, factory food country that I don't think we take enough care to keep most of our food safe to begin with. If something is inherently a more dangerous product, here's the deal. I would eat anything Rick Moonen cooked for me of any type of food, because I know where it comes from. You know the importer. You know who got it off the plane. You know that it's being treated well.
I'm a freak. Yeah.
But,
and your kitchen's probably clean.
Yeah. But when it comes to people that are, you know, paying minimum wage employees to and they're importing it and they're trying to save, you know, three cents on a supersize order, no.
Yeah.
Like, don't let them play around with fucking lungs and things that are going to kill me. So,
all right.
No.
All right. What's the next question? We're two for two.
This is really easy. Beluga caviar, queen conch, sea turtles, redfish, and on land, bushmeat and swan.
Well, most of those.
I'm the godfather of sustainability, so I'm not answering that.
This is a slow pitch softball for you, Rick.
Most of those are going to sound endangered, but as far as bushmeat, I think it's because it's a monkey and it's too close to human, right? And we get our own version of mad cow if we start eating
Sort of all of the above. Bushmeat, a lot of those are endangered as well. Yeah. I mean, we're talking tigers and things like that.
Good reason.
I think bushmeat was specifically primate.
No, it's a.
It's not on my list of things.
Anything from the bush.
Oh, anything
in Africa.
From the bush. Yeah. Bush in the bush.
Finally, literally and figuratively, ahi, pufferfish, sassafras oil.
Because they're poisonous and they can kill you unless they're prepared properly. And once again, I go back to the idea that if Rick Moonen wants to prepare me pufferfish, I will eat it and I get as high as a kite.
No, you try it. You try it.
As Homer Simpson said in one of the first seasons of The Simpsons, fugu me.
Fugu.
But no, I'm not. I'm fine with the fact that the average guy in the average corner sushi place is not trying to make that.
I'm
trying. I thought you were going to ask a question, but there's a little nut that tastes like vanilla.
There was that was on the list, and it didn't make the cut for time.
Do you remember what it's called? Because that's what I was waiting for you to say it.
No, I don't. But I'll send you the link.
Because it has curcumin in it. And curcumin is a blood thinner.
Yeah.
Coumadin is also it's from the same thing. Blah, blah, blah. Mm. Crazy stuff, you know.
Not good.
It's delicious. That's all I'm going to say.
You tell people it's illegal, they're going to think it's more delicious.
Yeah, when you say food you could die for.
That's
here you go.
Well, these will not kill you, but getting to our weekly cannabis edibles review, we've got these sweet stone green apple. Man, tell me what you think of this. I got this over at Zenleaf. It's from Encore Edibles. 10 pieces. They're supposed to be green apple flavored. They all come individually wrapped inside a little twist-off container. So I do like the fact that they won't melt together in your car and you can save them and all that shit. But
it's hard.
It's a hard candy, right?
Suck it like
it looks
a
like a jujube.
I mean, it really looks like somebody made it in their kids.
I could replace
deformed.
A tooth with that, you know?
Because you're going to lose a tooth if you chomp into that.
I mean, this seriously looks like stoners were making this or else some kids in their art class.
What's a lozenge?
And then, it tastes okay. Problem I had with the one that I had the other night, first of all, you can't.
Is that a 5 or 10?
You can't microdose. That's 10 milligrams, okay. Right? So, can't microdose, which is why I'm probably not going to finish this one because it's early in the day.
Yeah.
But as you start chewing on these, they get stuck in your teeth. You definitely have to just suck on them, not chew on them. And
I'll be honest with you. When it comes to edibles, I don't want it to last a long, long time in my mouth, you know, because even for the short period of time that we just had it in our mouth, you still have that flavor, you know.
That weed flavor.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of weed flavor in this one.
No.
I have been told, and I don't know if there's any truth to this, it might be an urban myth if anybody's listening, but that when you're doing like a lozenge or something like that, because you're absorbing some of the THC or the CBD, whatever, through your through the mucous membranes, right, that it's actually going straight into your bloodstream rather than going through your liver and being metabolized first. I don't know. So you might get a slightly different high. That's why smoking is a different high than edibles as a general
straight
rule.
Straight to the
how
blood.
How they're metabolized. So I have not noticed anything better, worse, different in the high that I get. But, you know, that's not what I'm really here to talk about. We're here to talk about the product, and honestly, this looks like something that was made in a kid's kindergarten class. I just like a really stoned kindergarten teacher decided to have arts and crafts. I don't know. Not totally in love with this one.
I agree.
Yeah.
Not my favorite.
And that, I believe, is it for this episode of Food and Loathing. Thanks to our guest, the now-retired Review Journal writer, Heidi Napranella. I'm kind of excited. I mean, I feel bad for the town, Heidi, not being here to write anymore. I hope they get another good food writer at the RJ, but I'm bringing her on board to write on my new project, Beast, which we're going to be talking about soon.
Who's going to fill the void?
I don't know. I do. You want a job, Rick?
No.
You want to go over and write for the RJ? All those things that you said that I did poorly, you can see how well you do them within
I never
sell you the beast.
I always suck up.
I'd apply, except I'd probably be forced to use the word unctuous sometime, and I refuse.
You'd have to say cocktail program.
Don't say yummy. Yummy's bad word.
But anyway, so Heidi will be doing a little writing, hopefully, for my project, The Neon Feast. We'll have more to talk to you about that within the next week or two.
Please tell a friend about Food and Loathing and say nice things about us, especially on Apple Podcasts. But either way, we do want your feedback, your likes, your retweets. Find everything you need to know about how to do all that at Al's website, which is theneonmohawk.com. Or just reach us direct with a whole other way to get there, and that's email. Electronic mail, as it's known. info@foodandloathing.vegas.
With producer Rich Johnson and Rick Moonen, I'm Al Mancini. Stay hungry.